We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. For many people, the Alabama town of Tuskegee will forever be associated with racism in medicine. Over a 40-year period, hundreds of African-American men were subjects in a study of syphilis. Those who had the disease were told that they were being treated, and in fact, they were only being watched. They were never told that they were part of a government study. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be trying to talk a little bit about this event and look at why it has such power in our collective memory. And our guest for the program is Susan Reverby. She is the author of a book, recently published book, which is entitled Examining Tuskegee, the Infamous Syphilis Study and Its Legacy, and it's published by the UNC Press. And my mistake there in mentioning the name of Marion Butler is because Susan Reverby is Marion Butler McLean Professor in the History of Ideas and Professor of Women's Studies at Wellesley College. The book is just recently out, and we're pleased that she could spend some time talking with us about it. Questions are certainly welcome. If people who are listening want to join the conversation, there are a couple of ways that they can do that. First of all, you may call if you're here in Champaign-Urbana. 333-9455 is the number. We also have a toll-free line that's good to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And you may also email your comments and questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. But in any case, any way you do it, we hope people will try to make their comments brief. That way we can accommodate as many different callers as possible. Well, Professor Reverby, hello.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, I appreciate very much you giving us some of your time. This is, I think, when people hear Tuskegee, they will certainly have associations with that. They may, in fact, say, oh, yes, I know what that was all about. I think one of the points that you would want to make is that some of the things that people would say they know may, in fact, not be true, or their understanding might be incomplete. So probably what we should do just to start is talk, I'll ask you to talk just in a very basic way about what this study was.
I think the easiest way to start is to tell you what it wasn't. Okay. It was not a study to infect men with the disease. What the United States government was concerned with was this sexually transmitted disease called syphilis, and they believed that it was a different disease, quote unquote, in black and whites. And so what they did was to find men who they thought were in the late latent, that is not contagious, stage of the disease, and to follow them, to watch them for 40 years between 1932 and 1972.
Mm-hmm. And just to make again, to underscore the point, I think you would say that that there are a lot of people who do think that these men were deliberately infected with syphilis by the government. And in fact, that was not true.
That was not true. And I would argue that the racism of the study is actually worse because it isn't true. Because here were people who had a disease that were not being treated, that were being lied to and told by the government that they, in fact, were being given aspirins and tonics and some rubs in order to be treated. So I think the disease is worse because it becomes much – I mean, what happened is worse because it becomes much more normative. We're used to the situation where we can't afford care, we don't get help. And so it becomes kind of symbolic for all of the limitations in health disparities in America. If these men and their families had had access to decent medical care, the study would never have happened.
Mm-hmm. Another point maybe that's worth making is that this went on for a long time.
Four decades.
Right. And it begins at a time when medicine really actually didn't have much to offer in the way of treatment for people who had syphilis.
Well, syphilis is a complicated disease, and when people were in the earliest stages and contagious, there were drugs that were available. But the idea of this study, although it wasn't always true, they tried to find people who had had the disease for at least 5 years. And so they were attempting to treat people who they thought could no longer pass the disease on to their families and had about a 50-50 chance of being harmed themselves. That doesn't make it any better. It's still a horrific study and probably the worst, longest running non-treating study that we know of in American history.
Were there other similar studies that identified other ethnic or racial groups, or was this the only one that singled out a particular group of people?
Well, it's interesting. When one of the men, doctors who ran the study, was asked that in the 1990s, so 20 years after the study ended, he said, well, if we could have found a group of West Virginia hillbillies, we would have done it on them. So there's that attitude. But in fact, because there was the belief that the disease was different in African Americans, and this is where the problem comes, when the idea that race, which is a social category, is supposed to be a biological category, you make all sorts of errors. So they assume that the previous studies on whites would not be applicable to an African American population.
One of the central questions here is for the doctors that were involved in the study, what it was they thought they were doing, and particularly whether they thought what they were doing was harmful.
No, they didn't. That's what's so interesting. Partly there was a debate going on in medicine in the 30s and 40s, this is before penicillin, about whether the drugs really worked when you got older and had the disease a longer time. So you could imagine in the modern context, you might say, the doc would come to you and say, look, Mr. Jones, you know, if you take this, it might help you, but there are all these side effects from these drugs. Maybe we should do watchful waiting. Right? That's a reasonable argument. You know, many of us have experienced that with our doctors. What happened here was the men, in fact, were told they were being treated for bad blood. They were never given the option of taking and saying no. So the doctors thought they were doing the right medical thing, but they didn't ask them. And then the question becomes, when penicillin becomes widely available in the late 40s and is being used for people with syphilis at every stage of the disease, why aren't they given it then? And in part, I think what happens to the docs is that they fall in love with their data. They realize that this disease is going to end, they think, without any of the information about really what happens over a long term. And this is a data set, a group of patients that they'll never see again, because everybody will be treated with penicillin. So I think they rationalize in a way and said to themselves, well, you know, it's not so harmful. In some cases, it doesn't really bad, blah, blah, blah. They probably wouldn't get to care anyway. And so it just goes on and on and on.
And they managed to find ways to justify what it was they were doing.
Yes. And the justification changed over time.
And the men were never told that they were part of this long-term study?
No, absolutely not. None of them have ever said they understood it. Although, think about the problem we have now, even with clinical trials. Sometimes people don't understand the difference between a research study and being treated. So we think about if you're in the last stages of a bad cancer, for example, and you find a clinical study, you could be treated with the best medicine we have now and some experimental drug, and it may or may not be better for you, but it might not be. And so I think it's hard sometimes for people to understand the difference between medical treatment and medical research.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Susan Reverby. She is a professor in the history of ideas and professor of women's studies at Wellesley College and is author of a newly published book that's titled Examining Tuskegee. It's about the infamous, as the subtitle suggests, the infamous syphilis study and its legacy. And it is published by the University of North Carolina Press. Questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455, and also email will-talk@illinois.edu. Why was it that this happened at Tuskegee, at the place that it did?
I think the study actually wouldn't have as much power in American culture if it hadn't happened here, because here is the place that Booker T. Washington has built, this center of black education in the rural South and built during the worst of the Jim Crow era. So here's a place that has enormous meaning for African Americans. The Public Health Service chose Tuskegee because there had been a previous study that was a treatment program done in six counties in the South. Macon County, which is the county that surrounds Tuskegee, was one of them. And there was a hospital there. There was a place to get the x-rays, to do the autopsies. And there had been, in the previous control project, a very high rate of syphilis. So they thought they would find a lot of people. So they picked it because they could find the bodies that they could use. They had medical cooperation from Tuskegee Institute. They had a large enough population, and it was near what became CDC, so it was easier to get to. And because they wanted African-American men in particular for this study, and there was a large population in the counties, about 80% African-American.
And were there people who participated in the study not as subjects but as people who were involved in carrying out the study who were also African-American?
Absolutely. The Institute itself agreed to the study. A man named Eugene Dibble was the medical director of the hospital at Tuskegee, and he agreed to the study and worked on it his entire career. And the person that often gets talked about was a public health nurse whose name was Eunice Rivers Laurie, who was the go-between the Public Health Service and the men. So part of the way in which the men's interest in the study is kept is that Rivers becomes their kind of private public health nurse. So if their family, and these are people who can't afford medical care for much of their lives, who live out in the rural boonies of a county that gets really muddy, and they're still driving, in the 30s, they're still driving mules and wagons that get stuck in the mud. And Rivers had a car, and she would drive out to help them. I spoke to her pastor, and he said she brought people food and clothing before there were food stamps and welfare money. And so she was this wonderful, caring figure who helped connect them and who helped get rid of sort of the worst of the racism of some of the white physicians. She would tell them to speak more kindly to the men. And so I think in her viewpoint, I mean, she died before I began the book, so I never got to interview her. But in her interviews with other people and her own oral testimony, she makes it sound like she thought the disease wasn't so terrible at this stage, that these people were getting better than the people she knew in the community who had no real access to health care.
So she somehow could justify that, saying, well, there was a trade-off here and that there might be some benefits to these men, maybe also to their families, that otherwise they wouldn't have.
Absolutely. And then the other question that I raise in the book that's probably the most controversial is that we know, if any of your listeners are old enough to have remembered what it was like in the 50s in particular around penicillin, this was the new miracle drug. So you sneezed and went to a doctor and you got penicillin. We weren't so aware at that point about the possibility of antibiotics being overcome by their bacteria. So in the 50s, it's not the 30s. Some of these men have children who went on to college, who became educated, who take their fathers to other medical care, and many of the men moved out of the county, as happened in the interwar and war years after the war. So some of them actually made it to penicillin for other illnesses that may or may not have made a difference in their disease. And some of the evidence suggests that both Dr. Dibble at Tuskegee and Nurse Rivers were helping people get to penicillin. So then the question becomes, did they keep the study going, and were they actually treating people, on the side or helping them get to treatment, but keeping them in the study because it got them death benefits and other kinds of care? And that's the controversial argument I make in the book. And the medical evidence is sort of mixed on this. We know that a lot of them got to penicillin at the end. Whether it made a difference or not at that point in their lives, it's really hard to know. Mm-hmm. But how did they get there? So did she do it? Did Dibble do it? And Dibble died in 1968 before the study ended, so we never got to ask him that question.
One of the things that seems remarkable about it is that this study went on so long. It went on into the post-war era and finally stopped because somebody blew the whistle on it. And one wonders, well, how much longer it would have gone on had that not happened.
I think it probably would have gone on forever until all of the men died. If someone had, a man named Peter Buxton finally tried to make it stop. And what's interesting is that a number of people, starting really in the 50s, wrote to the Public Health Service and said, or called them, or questioned them. And they, kept saying, it's really okay. It's really, really okay. And in the end, they came back into the county in the late 60s and spoke to the local medical society, which by that point was like 95% African American. And it's not exactly clear what they said to them, but the study just kept going. And it's a good example of that kind of inertia where people just didn't understand what was happening. And the other thing that's really important to understand about this study, it wasn't being done like in a concentration camp like the Nazis, in a back room where nobody knew about it. There were 13 published articles about this in major medical journals. So you would read about this, and it would say, and the title of the studies were Untreated Syphilis in the Male Negro. That was the formal title. So what's fascinating is the extent to which it became so normative to not see or understand what this meant that most people who read this in the major journals didn't understand what they were reading.
So did people in the Public Health Service believe that this would yield some valuable information that would help overall in understanding and treating syphilis?
Absolutely. And what's interesting about it is that they thought the disease was different in African Americans, which is why they studied them. And then they thought the results could be generalized to everybody, white or black. So they hoped that they would learn whether and one way you can sort of, if you stop for a minute and get over your total revulsion, which is very difficult to do, you can imagine that here they're saying, look, it's a public health problem. We have limited resources. Maybe we should just make sure we only give the penicillin to the younger people who get it immediately, who can then – it's contagious and they can pass it on, or a pregnant woman can give it to her fetus. But if you've lived 25 years with this disease, we shouldn't waste resources. We shouldn't give it out. So then it becomes, not so unreasonable to try to figure it out. And you could imagine that if you told somebody, look, you've got a 50-50 chance. Are you willing to be in the study? That some people would say yes. The point, of course, is that the men never were given that choice. Never.
Well, that you talked a little earlier about even today, with the kind of informed consent that we have, it's difficult for people to understand, if they're participating in a study, just exactly what that means for them as individuals. I guess one would also have to say that at this time, the standard here for what you told people, how well you informed them if they were taking part in some kind of medical research. I don't know that this – was this any worse than any other studies that were done at the time?
I think it's worse because it goes on so long, and there is a conversation going on by the 50s and 60s about this. And we're talking about post-Nuremberg and post-the Nazi era. But what's fascinating about this is another scholar interviewed one of the docs involved in the study, and he said to him, well, didn't Nuremberg and the Nazis give you pause? And this doc turned to him and said, but they were Nazis. So I think part of the problem with Tuskegee and the way the story gets told is that people think the study only took place in the 30s, and they can say in their head the equivalent of this doc's comment, they were just racists and it was a long time ago, rather than understanding how this kind of problem persists in a different form now. How do we make really clear to patients, if they're in a study, what it means, what their options are, and how hard that is for all of us who are lay people to make the appropriate medical judgment? And a lot of people turn to their physician and say, well, doc, what do you think? Right? It's really hard in that situation. I mean, I was in a situation once with my son who had a seizure, and they were about to do the brain scan that would tell me whether or not he had a seizure disorder. And as I'm walking in, they say to me, oh, by the way, do you mind if we keep him for 20 more minutes under the scanner to do some research? And I'm thinking, these are the people who are going to tell me whether my kid has a tumor. Of course I said yes. So did I have informed consent as a PhD historian of medicine? Yes. Did I really make the right decision in that situation? No, I was too scared.
You know, I don't want to make it sound like I would suggest that this was in any way justified, but at the same time, I guess I want to ask the question, did anything, any beneficial information about syphilis and how the disease progresses and how it can be treated, and did anything like that come out of this study?
Very little. That's the saddest, in some ways, part of it. And because the study was a mess. Some of the men had actually had some treatment at the beginning of the study. When they discovered that people who were in the control arm, that is the people who didn't have the disease, got the disease, they switched them into the syphilitic arm. People in the syphilitic arm who turned up at autopsy not to really have syphilis never got switched back into the control arm. So the data is a mess. In lots of ways. What I think it did teach us is about racism in medicine. And in that sense, that's the important legacy of this study. It teaches us about the limitations of assuming that a whole population based on its skin color will have a disease in a similar way. It teaches us about what happens when there's scientific hubris about how you treat patients. It teaches us to think about treating people as individuals and not as populations. So to the extent to which the men's unknowing sacrifice got us to think about that, and then all of us who get protected, who have informed consent, who know that there's an institutional review board that looks at the science, all of that happened post Tuskegee, and it made the difference in making that happen.
You talked about the fact that there were some men who were believed to have had the disease, were assigned to that group in the study, that then when they died on autopsy, it was determined that, in fact, they didn't have syphilis. How, at the outset, where they were looking for people to be in this study, did they determine whether one did or did not have the disease?
There's two ways. One is they would take a history from the person and ask them whether or not they had a sore at the point of the physical contact where the disease was passed, mostly on the genitalia. And then they would do a blood test. And there were several blood tests. And it was a history of getting false positives on some of these tests. And then over time, and then they would look at the symptoms. I mean, the disease has been around for a very long time. There's a huge debate about whether it starts in the Americas and gets carried back to Europe by Columbus's debauching men, or whether Columbus's debauching men bring it to the Americas. But it appears first in the 15th century in Naples and is quite serious, and then spreads throughout the European world. So there's a long history of treating it with various diseases. The expression, a night with Venus leads to a lifetime with mercury, comes from the use of mercury as the major cure for most of this disease's history.
Mm-hmm. And that, I guess that goes back to the idea that at least for some of the disease's history, that some people thought that the cure was almost as bad as the disease itself.
Exactly. Some of the symptoms that we see with syphilis could, in fact, have been mercury poisoning. If you think about insanity as one of the outcomes of the disease, and think about the Mad Hatter in Alice in Wonderland, he's the Mad Hatter because he used mercury to stiffen the felt on the hat. So if you think about that, there were many people who thought the treatments were actually worse. And with penicillin, if the person already had severe damage to their aorta, for example, in their heart, penicillin couldn't fix that. But it might have stopped people who had neurological damage, for example, or were about to get it. We just will never really know.
We are at our midpoint here, and our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Susan Reverby. She is a professor in the history of ideas and professor of women's studies at Wellesley College, and she is the author of a new book, Examining Tuskegee. The subtitle is The Infamous Syphilis Study and Its Legacy, and it's published by the University of North Carolina Press. Questions are certainly welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Also email will-talk@illinois.edu. You know, a little earlier I talked to you, asked you about how it is that this went on so long, and you said that you thought maybe if someone hadn't blown the whistle on this, it might still be going on. And again, I guess that goes back to this question that it wasn't a secret. And as you said, there were papers that were written about it. So it seemed like there had to be a number of people who knew about it. And again, one wonders why it is that it didn't, that sooner it didn't, the story didn't get out. Some newspaper didn't come along and write a story, that someone didn't stand up and say, look, here this is going on and it's really wrong and something ought to be done about it.
Well, people did try, as I said, in the 50s and into the 60s, a group of people in Washington tried. They called a press conference. But, you know, it was a period where, if you think back to the 60s, where there were lots of these kinds of declarations being made. So newspapers didn't sort of pick up on it. And I think it speaks to this long history of the use of poor people and black people in particular's bodies as research. For research and teaching, that the idea somehow was that if you went to a teaching hospital that you paid for your care with the right to essentially you gave up your rights and that new medical students could come in and learn on you. And so I think there's a kind of medical culture that this becomes part of, so that people even reading the articles, and this is true of both white, you know, liberal physicians and of black physicians in the black medical schools who even taught the study and didn't think that it was wrong. And then the other thing is that some of the reports called the men volunteers. So unless you really sort of delved into it or called the CDC or the Public Health Service and said, sort of, wait a minute, what's going on, you might not notice it. So the interesting story is the man who breaks the study in the end is a guy named Peter Buxton, who's still alive, lives in San Francisco. And he was working in San Francisco as a syphilis tracker. He was working in the really tough neighborhoods of, and he reads about the study, or somebody tells him about it, and he sends for all the papers. This is before the internet. And then he says, oh my God, this is just awful. And then he starts writing letters and calling them, and they bring him into, you know, Atlanta, and they yell at him and then tell him he doesn't know what he's talking about. And it goes on and on. So Peter starts this in like 64, 65. And finally, in 1972, he's having drinks with some buddies of his. And one of them is a woman who's an AP reporter. And she says, what? They're doing what? And then Peter says, well, here's all the information. So she calls her bosses at AP. They give the story to a more senior reporter named Jean Heller. And she breaks the story in July of 1972. And then, of course, all hell breaks loose everywhere over this study. And what happens after that is a lawsuit. Ted Kennedy has hearings in which the men are brought in. There's a federal panel that's formed. And then it becomes part of our collective consciousness as an example of the horrific things that can be done.
Did the Public Health Service in any sort of public way stand up and say, yes, we did this, it was wrong, we should have stopped a long time ago, we're sorry, anything like that?
Yes, they did, actually. Once the story broke, and I think some of the people, not everybody in the PHS, but certainly some of the leadership and some of the men who ran the docs who ran the study began to realize what had happened. So you get some sorts of apologies and attempt. And what happened is all of the people who could be identified who were still alive or their wives, and in some cases their children, were given lifetime health benefits. I mean, it doesn't make up for the death and destruction that happened, but they were given lifetime health benefits by the Public Health Service. And then I was part of a group, a number of us were involved in this, and in 1997, we got a final federal apology from President Clinton in the White House in May of 1997, when six of the men who had been in the study were still alive. So they came and their families came to that. So there has been a federal apology. There was a new bioethics center funded by CDC was set up at Tuskegee to help train another generation of bioethicists and people in the community about these issues.
What sort of thing, those men who did actually talk about the experience and how they felt about it, what sort of things did they say?
Well, mostly what they talked about was what it meant to be lied to by your government. The man who was the key spokesman at the apology and in some of the videos that have been done was a gentleman named Herman Shaw, who died in 2001 and lived into his 90s. And he said, very clearly, we were full-blooded American citizens. This should never have been done to us. So I think there was this sense of being betrayed by both your doctors and by your government. And when you think about it, when Mr. Shaw signed up for the study, it was during the Depression. His family was doing badly on their land, and he was trying to help them. So again, if he had had access to better medical care in the 30s, he never would have done it. He was doing what was best for his family. So I think the sense of betrayal in particular is what is so anger-making for them. And, you know, I think what's happened over the years is both in Tuskegee as a city and then in the African-American community and then with the apology, I think all Americans have apologized to these families, but many of the families carry the burden of knowing that their fathers and grandfathers and great-grandfathers and uncles and cousins were in this study, and that's a difficult burden for many people to take.
We have a couple of callers to talk with. Let's start with Champaign County and line number 4. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned earlier that I guess you've studied or you alluded to the idea that the medical establishment, whatever you want to call it, has for many decades sort of used poor and particularly black people as research without, you know, the usual kinds of informed consent, I guess. I would like for you to elaborate on that. I mean, I know that there's a lot to be told about this specific instance, but this broader issue that you raised, it seems to be important. I'm kind of sensitive to it in an odd way, and I have a little anecdote, which is that I had an African-American dentist for many years, and I was researching implants, and he told me that he was incredibly skeptical of it. I brought him some European studies, and now I've had an implant, and it's fine, but he told me that he thought that it was bad, and he knew all these stories about in prisons of all these people having, you know, new procedures tried on them that effect, and that's probably just the tip of the iceberg, and I don't know if it's too productive to, but I know that the African-American community is quite sensitive to this issue, and it's very little spoken of, so I'll hang up and listen to if you have anything to say about that specifically or whether you're researching that further, because I think that's the broader topic.
I'd be glad to answer. First of all, prisoners, what your dentist told you is probably absolutely correct. That is, for a very long time, and actually we're really discussing it now, prisoners were, in fact, the best population to test anything on. There's a wonderful book called Acres of Skin, which is about dermatological testing in one of the major state prisons in Pennsylvania. And so prisoners were great because they weren't leaving. You could get their medical records. You could keep them around to follow up what happened. And for many prisoners who were very bored with their research, it was a kind of perk, actually. And so for a long time, actually, in prisons, only the white prisoners, not the black prisoners, got to be in the research studies because it was considered a good thing to be doing. So we have a long history of using people in the – if you think about the earliest LSD research was done on people in the armed forces. The earliest radiation research was people in the armed forces. So we have a really interesting problem. If medicine is going to make progress, we have to have human subjects. So how do we make it as fair as possible? But certainly historically, whether people were black, in Boston in the 19th century, the experiments were done on the Irish. So we have a long history of using poor people for this kind of research. And I think one of the things that's important now should be to talk about, and it's one of the reasons why when I was asked about my son, I said yes, was not just because I was worried about what they would tell me, but because I thought the burden of research should be shared. We need that for progress, but the question is, who are we using to make that happen, and how much do they understand what's happening to them?
And is it still common that prisoners are thought of as good subjects or at least available subjects for medical research?
We stopped using prisoners for quite a while, but it is actually being in the medical ethics literature. It is being redebated at the moment about whether or not this is ethical or not. So these things change. It raises really complicated questions about what kind of, quote, freedom, as it were, do you have to make that kind of decision when you're in prison?
All right. To someone on a cell phone next, line 1. Hello. Could call it there, line 1. All right, just a moment. Well, hold on. We'll see if we can get with that caller. I'll just take the opportunity to introduce again our guest, Susan Reverby. She teaches at Wellesley College. She's a professor in the history of ideas and also professor of women's studies. She is the author of a recently published book entitled Examining Tuskegee, the Infamous Syphilis Study and Its Legacy, and that's published by the University of North Carolina Press. If people would like to call in, ask questions, make comments, they certainly may. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think we now have that caller, line number one. Hello?
Hello, my question. I was just to know, have the researcher talk about how, what her book brings new to the subject, since there's been an awful lot written about it. And I'll just hang up and listen.
All right.
My publisher asked me the same question. Totally reasonable. I'd say two things, really. One is I retailed the beginning of the story, so in simpler terms, so I think people can understand what happened. I raised the question of whether or not some of these people got to treatment itself. And then a bulk of the book explains why individuals got involved in it and then why the story carries such weight in our American culture. So the last part of the book is called Traveling. How does it come that we know about this? I mean, why did this not just be a big newspaper story in 1972 and then go away? And I would argue that Tuskegee, like lynching and slavery, becomes a word that explains what happens when we don't treat African Americans as rights-bearing citizens in this country. And it becomes a way to explain a whole series of other horrific things that happened. So, for example, when Spike Lee, the black filmmaker, was arguing over what happened in New Orleans during Katrina, he made the argument that maybe the government had let the levees fail. And when some Fox News broadcaster said to him, oh, well, that's just ridiculous, Spike Lee said, well, this is the government that did Tuskegee. So it becomes a way to explain terrible things that happen. And so I try to explain why the word gets used and how it matters. So I think that's what my book brings to it. And I hope it also, because I had access to the men's medical records, which is the first time this has been published in a long form, I was able to really say what I thought happened to them individually.
Do you know, one of the things that we see now is that there are people who really mistrust the medical community. And one way that we see that is in this resistance that some people have to vaccinating their children for common childhood disease. And also there seems to have been some resistance to the major public health effort aimed at trying to get people vaccinated for flu, for influenza, and that people seem to be very distrustful. They're concerned about possible side effects. Now, you could see that a story like this would have an effect within the African-American community. Does it generalize outside of that? Does it contribute to this overall sort of mistrust of medicine?
Yes, I think so. I think it gets used by lots of people, even if they don't know what it means. But in you can understand, I mean, most of us come to a medical encounter in some ways frightened. When we go see a doctor or we ask for a vaccine, it's a leap of faith on some level, right? Mm-hmm. It says, you're going to help me. I might die. My children might be hurt. So we bring to it a kind of upsetness anyway, even if we're not conscious of it. And so anything that sort of looks and then we become a mistrustful people, you know, over the years. And there are enough stories about things that go wrong that it's hard to know when people are being trustworthy. So I think the lesson for this is, in fact, that medicine has a lot of work to do to gain people's trust, that we can't just assume that because somebody went to medical school that they'll know what they're doing. And I think that a lot of us come to this with a lot of fear. And in that sense, I think the internet makes things worse because you can find anything you want to support whatever position you want if you look things up. So, you know, I often call my doc and say, so according to Dr. Internet, this is what I have. Now, you went to medical school, you tell me. And there's no way to know. You know, you look at this stuff or patients call, you look at patient sheets of people who have certain diseases are reporting it. You don't have any data. How do you make that decision? So I think part of the problem speaks to medicine's failure to educate patients, but also our failure to understand how science works, to be able to evaluate information, our failure to have good enough math lessons and quantitative teaching so that we can evaluate things ourselves, and we get scared.
Well, we have just about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Susan Reverby. Again, we're talking about her book, Examining Tuskegee, the Infamous Syphilis Study and Its Legacy. It's just out. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. You talked right at the beginning about one major myth that circulates about this study. That is that the men were actually infected with syphilis by the Public Health Service, which is not true. Are there some other important things that people think they know about this study that that aren't true?
I think that there is a myth as well that the Public Health Service killed all of the men. So there were 624 men altogether in the study, 427 who supposedly had the disease, 185 who were the controls, and 12 who were switched back and forth. And those numbers are a little flaky. So round ballpark, 600 people involved in the study. But the assumption is often made that every single one of them was killed by the Public Health Service, and that's not true. Now, I would argue that even if one man died, or one family got infected, that makes this a horrific tragedy. But I think there's an assumption that this was a disease that would have killed all of them immediately or over time, and that isn't true. And I think the myth of infecting is really an important one because it really does then tie, as I said earlier, ties the study to Mengele and to Nazis and to sort of our imagined Frankenstein-like view of physicians who will do the most horrific things to patients without caring. And I think I think the important thing to think about is that these docs actually didn't think they were harming these men, and that's what makes the story in some ways much more powerful.
Mm-hmm. We have another caller, someone on a cell phone. We'll go there next, line 4. Hello. So caller there on line 4. Well, I don't know. I guess we can try again to make sure that maybe they weren't hearing us clearly or didn't understand that it was time for them to go. In any case, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and will-talk@illinois.edu. You talked a little bit earlier about one of the things that you had the opportunity to do was to look at the medical records of the men who were in the study to get a better idea of what exactly had happened to them. These men had families. What was the impact, the effect of, say, the wives, the partners of these men and their children?
Right. We can only tell a little bit. The medical records, if anyone is interested, by the way, are actually available to anyone. They are in the National Archives in Morrow, Georgia, and anyone can have access to them. What we do know is that at least by the time the study ends in 1972 and the Public Health Service then offers medical care, that 22 of the wives were tested positive for syphilis, 17 of the children and 2 grandchildren. So those are the people who ended up getting help from the Public Health Service as well. Whether the men had sexual partners who were not their wives, we don't know. No one did any tracking to find that out. But certainly it is a sexually transmitted disease, and it's a disease that a pregnant woman, if she is in the early stage of disease, can also pass it on to her fetus at birth. But it is not, and sometimes people think this, it's not a hereditary disease. That is, it's not a disease that can be passed down in your genes or in your blood from one generation to another. You have to transfer it. So there's another myth about it too, that somehow any ills of a third or fourth generation can be blamed on this disease, and that's not true.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that people who were involved in carrying out this study would have said right from the beginning, they would have said, well, look, the people that we have in our study are in the late stage of the disease. At this point, it's not contagious. So from the point forward where they get into the study, they're passing it on to somebody else is just not an issue.
Well, that's what they're assuming. I did, however, do a small subsample of the records to look at whether the men, in fact, were 5 years out or not, and a number of them weren't. So were some of these guys still contagious? Probably. And their wives' names are crossed out in the records for privacy reasons, so it's really tricky to try to figure out. The Public Health Service claimed that anybody who was still contagious was treated. So we don't know. The cross out could be to protect their privacy, or so did they get treatment or not? You can't tell. And yet we still have 22 women at the end of the study and 72 who are still alive who actually got the disease. So, you know, it gets it's messy. It's just really messy and awful what happened.
Yeah. We'll try to get back to that caller. This is someone in Monticello and on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm just curious to know how this book compares with the one by Jim Jones published about 35 years ago on the same subject.
Jim Jones is – thank you for asking. We're actually very good friends, and he wrote a blurb for mine. I'd say that the difference between my book and Jones's book called Bad Blood is that it takes this much more complicated picture of what happened. It raises the question about whether the men ever got to treatment, and then it looks at the story post-1972, which Jones's book does extremely briefly, and mine really tries to do it. And then he didn't really look at individuals involved in it except for Nurse Rivers, and I do much more with the white doctors, with the men. I also had access to the medical records, which Jones did not.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
All right. And
you're welcome.
We'll go to someone here in Urbana, where we are. This is line 1. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Mm-hmm.
Were any, I mean, by the time all this came out public, I know in the latter 80s and 90s, I mean, i.e., you know, the apologies and the apologia, bringing the people in, were all the physicians deceased at that time, the people that were, and sort of like, who authorized this? I mean, was it a localized in the South, or was it some, you know, a larger organization? I don't know if the CDC existed back then, a public health department probably is what you were talking about. Was anybody ever prosecuted for this? I mean, were there any legal actions other than maybe giving these gentlemen, the survivors, money? Was anybody like, I mean, right now, I think people would go to jail for doing something
right.
like this.
Right. Mm-hmm. The gentleman is correct. This, first of all, came from the United States Public Health Service, which precedes the Centers for Disease Control. And after the war, CDC takes over running it. Nobody was ever prosecuted. It's one of the things that people, particularly in Tuskegee, where I do a lot of work, were really angry about.
Mm-hmm.
So no prosecution. And you're absolutely right. I think now there would have been individual prosecutions. And some of the men, when the study broke, the story broke in 72. One of the docs who started it was pretty senile. Dibble had died. Some of the people who had run the study were still alive and actually just passed away within the last year or two. So there were people around who could have been sued. And in part, the private suit that defense attorney Fred Gray raised that raised money for the men did sue individual physicians as well. But there was never any criminal prosecution, which I suspect there would be now.
Thank you. Appreciate
it. Well, at what point would it have been possible for there to be a criminal prosecution, and what would the charge have been?
I think that would have been really difficult. We know, for example, that it's hard to bring federal charges on civil rights violations. So it would have been really tricky. You could have ended up having dueling, you know, medical experts who had said, look, it didn't really harm them. There was no real informed consent. Maybe they should have reported it, but lots of people did. Private doctors never reported syphilis to the state. So I think it would have been very difficult to bring a legal case in 72, and certainly not now. I think there's probably some kind of statute of limitations, unless you want to argue that it's murder, which you could, mm-hmm. in which case there is no statute of limitations. But that would have to happen, I think, in Alabama.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and I guess maybe, again, the place to come back to now that we've tried to lay out the basic story, and of course people want to read more, they can look at the book, and that is to talk about why it is that for so many people, this is the story is so powerful and it really has a hold on them, and they would say this is an important example of either of injustice, of racism, of the way that not only black and people of color are discriminated against, but also poor people are discriminated against. It feeds into general distrust of government. This is a really powerful story, and it's one that just seems like it won't go away.
I think that that's correct. I mean, Barack Obama 2 years ago in his race speech said Americans like their race stories as spectacle or tragedy. And in many ways, this story is both. It is a spectacle of horror in lots of ways and a tragedy of enormous dimensions. So it feeds a kind of narrative that we know, and it covers, as you said quite eloquently, all of those issues of mistrust, of racism, of doctor power, of our fear of the government and what it can do to us. And so my argument at the end of the book is that I hope that the details of the study will never be forgotten, but that in the search for justice, that the details and the memory of the word Tuskegee, in fact, will go away.
Was it, when the time came that the formal apology was made, this was during the Clinton administration and he did this in Washington, was that controversial at all? Can you talk a little bit about what was involved in getting to that point, what had to be done to get to that point?
What happened was some organizing within the Centers for Disease Control, a group of historians, activists from the community, people from the Black Congressional Caucus. And we thought we had a good issue at that point because Clinton was sensitive to race issues. It hadn't happened on either a Democratic Republican watch. It happened a long time ago. The men were aging. There was real concern about distrust in the African American community and rising consciousness about health disparities. So it was a good moment politically to have it happen. So we did a lot of organizing. We wrote our congresspeople. We worked within the Congress. People who were in the AIDS community, who had connections, worked on it, and Clinton agreed. So there was some controversy, I think, within CDC that bringing it up again would make things worse. But I would argue that it made a big difference to people to have the President of the United States say very eloquently, I am sorry that this happened. And I think it does matter. And there is a kind of redemption that comes from apologizing, which had never really happened formally before. And it did matter.
The book we're talking about here this morning is titled Examining Tuskegee. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press. The author is our guest, Susan Reverby. She's a professor in the history of ideas and professor of women's studies at Wellesley College. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on your show.